Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. We live in challenging times, not just interesting ones, and some of them are the sort that the Chinese mean with that famous curse, may you live in interesting times. They have created a funding stream from people probably like you, people who invest in Wall Street, capital markets, and perhaps unwittingly are having the fund managers, the masters of the universe, as we've come to call them, migrate a portion of your portfolio to China. And when I say to China, I mean to the Chinese Communist Party, to the entities that it owns and controls, some of which are directly tied to the People's Liberation Army, some of which simply work for the CCP, which means they work for the People's Liberation Army and the rest of this transnational criminal organization. It is a delight to say, when we turn to this topic, that we have with us one of our country's duty experts on the kind of economic warfare that this represents, the unrestricted warfare's economic component. He's studied it closely. He's been warning about it for years. He is championing things that can be done, practical things. And I'm very excited always to introduce my friend and colleague, Kevin Freeman. He is the host of his own television program, Economic War Room, with Kevin Freeman on Blaze TV and other platforms. He's a member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China. He's the author of two best-selling books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan, and a go-to guy on topics like what on earth is our financial sector doing, enabling, underwriting, and otherwise abetting our mortal enemy, the Chinese Communist Party. Kevin Freeman, welcome back to Securing America. It's good to have you, sir.
Thank you, Frank.
So I just want to bring this to a very tight focus. It's a big topic. We'll talk about it in broader detail in the course of, I'm sure, this program and others. But let me start by asking you, Kevin, about something that happened earlier this week. The Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board, an obscure government agency that manages the $800 billion federal retirement system known as the Thrift Savings Plan, opened a mutual fund window at midnight on Wednesday and now is encouraging, indeed endorsing, investment in mutual funds that at least some of them have Chinese companies of the kind I've just mentioned, some perhaps even sanctioned by our government in their portfolios. What are we to make of this decision, this development, and this danger?
You know, Frank, what it brings to mind are two thoughts. One of them is, could you imagine it's 1940 and we've opened up investments for our servicemen and women into Japan and Nazi Germany? I mean, it would just be horrific. Why would you do that? It would be the worst historical decision you could make. The second thought is that despite the growth of the Chinese economy over the last 20 plus years, it went from one tenth the size of ours to some estimate larger or roughly equal in size than ours over the last 20 years. It's happened because we funded it. We've done that. And what scares me about that is the idea, well, what if 20 years ago you decided to invest in a drug dealer and then he took over your neighborhood? I mean, oh, we made lots of money. We invested in a drug dealer. It's not about the investment. It's about what's good for the world. And this is clearly not good for the world.
No, that's so true. Kevin, you have been championing a very different model than that of, say, Larry Fink, the fellow who actually manages most of those $800 billion for this thrift savings plan. He has not only this fixation with migrating funds, as I said, to China, something he's been paid handsomely by the Chinese for doing, obviously. And he's not alone, but he's the 800-ton gorilla, I think it's fair to say, in Wall Street. But also, he's got something called environment social governance, ESG, that is his other fetish. And he's been trying to get everybody else to conform to it, even though that's completely at odds with how the Chinese operate. Talk a little bit about an alternative to this so-called ESG that you think is in order, and what you're doing to try to enable people who feel as you do and I do to invest patriotically instead.
Well, ESG is a progressive wish list of eliminating fossil fuels, social justice, critical race theory, and gender quotas, including LGBTQ. What we promote is LSV, liberty, security, and values. And we don't do that lightly. We do it because we think it's necessary for America, but we also do it because a poll after poll that we've conducted and others have conducted using similar or in some cases the exact same terminology find that people want to invest to protect their family and protect their country. Imagine that. And LSV, liberty, security, values, does specifically that. It is not some progressive agenda. It is what real Americans want to see happen. It is what we need to be doing. And we can profit from investing in liberty, security, and values. The Chinese don't want that, but the American people do. And so we're giving them a way to obtain that by finding good financial advisors who've been trained on the subject through Liberty University. We have an online course. It launched yesterday. We have our first class operating there. And we're just thrilled because people are accepting it and they're crying out, I want LSV, not ESG.
Yeah. Kevin, tell us a little bit more about this program, because while we've talked about it here, I just don't believe we can talk about it enough as a means of empowering American investors to utilize their funds to advantage our country instead of having other people utilizing their funds to endanger our country. And by the way, quite possibly the investors themselves in this thrift savings plan example, men and women in uniform are people who are going to be having their funds perhaps tapped by Chinese companies that are building weapon systems to kill them. So this is, I'd like to think, personal. Your thoughts?
Well, the problem is Wall Street's very complex, and you get a fund and you get an advertisement and you say, I want to get the best performance. But when you dig down and see what's involved in that, you realize that it's actually your holdings of stocks or ownership. And when you have that ownership, you have a say in how the company is run. Well, people like Larry Fink have taken that say away from you and said, hey, just invest in our fund and we'll do what we think is best, which could be telling Disney to be more woke. It could be telling ExxonMobil to exit the fossil fuels business. Or it could be telling people they need to be putting their money in communist China or in companies that are doing business that enhance communist China as they do things like monitor their people, develop social credit scores, do live human organ harvesting, concentration camps, religious repression. You know, they're taking our money and doing bad things with it, and people don't know. They don't know how to find that out. We train advisors to help them find out how and what they should do with it.
Now, this is the National Security Investment Consultants Institute. How do people find more about this project, and how most especially can they get their fund advisors, their investment advisors, if they have one, to sign up, take this course. And if they don't have an advisor, can you help them find one who is properly trained?
Okay, so first question, find out more at nsic.org, National Security Investment Consultant, nsic.org. And there you'll learn more about LSV investing. And you do need a financial advisor, but most advisors don't know how to do it. So they take our 8-week training course. And at the end of 8 weeks, they join the NSIC Institute and they'll be better prepared to help you. And if you have an advisor who won't take the course, send them to us and we'll train them. If not, find a new advisor.
Get a new one. Amen. Kevin Freeman's going to stay with us through the break. We'll be right back with more about food security and what's happening to it right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Within hours of the board that oversees the federal government's $800 billion retirement fund giving the Chinese Communist Party access to its participants' money, four Biden nominees to that board have signaled that they oppose the practice. In a letter to senators holding up their confirmation, the nominees to the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board wrote, quote, "We agree it is unfitting for Americans to invest in companies from China or elsewhere that undermine U.S. national security," unquote. Since that's what the Chinese communists are all about, and since every Chinese corporation must do their bidding, none should have access to Thrift Savings Plan funds. To assure military and civilian government employees won't unwittingly invest in our enemy, the Senate must not confirm these nominees until all Chinese companies are removed from mutual fund offerings endorsed by the current Thrift Savings Plan board membership. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We're talking with the host of Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. That would, of course, be Kevin Freeman. And we are talking with him about economic warfare against this country and what it means to you. Might it even mean the end, not just of your liberties or even our country, but of your own physical condition and that of your family? We're going to pivot in the latter case to the issue of food insecurity, which is now becoming not just a problem in a lot of other places around the world, but increasingly here. Kevin, you had one of our favorite duty experts on this subject on your wonderful program, Economic War Room, a fellow by the name of Ross Kennedy, very recently. Talk a little bit about what you and Ross have established is going on at the moment and why.
Yeah, the current episode on Economic War Room is all about food security. And what we walk through, you know, you've probably heard these rumors of fires at processing plants and food plants. Then there's the avian flu where they
I don't think they're rumors, are they? I think that there have been, in fact, an awful lot of these plants taken offline.
You're exactly right. You're hearing rumors of a concerted effort to take down plants, but there are dozens of plants that have been had mishaps. And some of it is like cyber attacks where they've been taken offline from cyber attacks. And the security people say, yeah, no, that's a real threat. Or fires at the plants, or other mishaps, or you have avian flu, where they've killed entire flocks of chickens because one bird had flu. And you look at that. And
you've even had two, as I understand it, that have had aircraft fly into them.
Yes.
Which reminds me of kind of 9/11. That's no accident, comrade, is it?
Well, you know, the Snopes says it's an accident. It's just a coincidence. These happen all the time. People just aren't looking out for them. But the reality of it is that our food supply is in worse condition than it's been in modern times. And the reality is the shelves are bare, whether it's bare from the infant formula because there was a problem in the plant and they didn't get in and look at the plant quickly enough, or if it is a supply chain issue, or if it is fertilizer from Russia that we're expecting but won't get because of the war, or if it's because the Russian wheat production or Ukrainian wheat production went down, we are facing a substantial food crisis. And that is not a rumor. The IMF says it. The United Nations says it. The Rockefeller Foundation says it. Bill Gates said, you know, across the board, everyone agrees, oh, there's food problems coming. And we see it in our grocery bill. The prices have skyrocketed. There are food shortages that are developing. We went from an abundance of food not long ago to massive shortages. And one has to step back and say, is this happening because everything's gone wrong all at once? Or is this happening because there's a concerted effort to impact our food supply? And I don't think that there is a legitimate way to shoot down that concern.
Yeah. Well, it does seem, Kevin, as though, drawing on what we talked about before the break, we're confronting adversaries who specialize in this doctrine of unrestricted warfare that endangering or even constricting our food supply at a moment when they're constricting an awful lot of other supply chains, how could they possibly miss this bet? And I'm talking here about specifically the Chinese Communist Party, which has, as I understand it from Ross, among others, been stockpiling, hoarding enormous amounts of food themselves. I mean, huge percentages of the world's supply of grains, I believe, and rice and corn. Have you satisfied yourself that this is not actually part of a plan on the Chinese Communist Party's part?
No, and I don't think you can. I think that's the point, is that you can't rule that out. Frank, you're the one who brought up the phrase, have you eaten lately? And the reality of it is that we're facing a mass food shortage, and the enemies of the United States that we know have conducted war in every other field of battle, potentially economic or financial or physical or societal or rare earth minerals. That same group of people, the Chinese Communist Party, has stockpiled food presciently and then watch this happen, you know, happenstance. I don't think that's true. I think it is very likely that they have a hand in this, but not just them. Major food processors, major food exporters, you know, World Health Organization. You walk through this and you say, you can't rule out a broad conspiracy here. I don't want to believe it, but there is just so much evidence that you can't rule it out.
Yeah. And Kevin, you know, you're a serious student of things economic, of course. This is a product in part of the same phenomena that has brought us these other supply chain dependencies, which is we'll just have a what they call just-in-time model. We'll move offshore where it's cheaper. The manufacturer of all kinds of things, or the source of raw materials in case of, as you say, rare earth minerals. And we'll just get it when we need it. And of course, it'll always be available to us when we need it, even though the people who have over time inexorably come to be able to actually cut off those supply chains are, as I said, our mortal enemies, the Chinese Communist Party. And, you know, this whole thing seems to be having a case of the wheels coming off the train, whether it's food, whether it's chips, whether it's medicines, as you say, rare earth minerals, and on and on. We've put ourselves in an extremely precarious position, to say the least. Can you give us any comfort that we're now rectifying that situation? And if so, can we do it in a timely enough way to prevent possible, well, disaster, food, and in some of these other cases as well?
Well, and when you say disaster, it goes beyond just traditional disaster. Starvation is a very serious thing, obviously. But a shortage of food also causes destabilization and riots. That was the cause of the Arab Spring. It is the number one most effective weapon that you can use to destabilize a society is to deny them food. Now, are we rectifying the situation? Unfortunately, it seems that the hands of government are either moving very slowly in addressing the problem, or, you know, we are literally destroying food. Some people are destroying it because they want to protect the climate, or we're destroying it because we're putting food in our gas tank in the form of ethanol because we don't want to drill, drill, drill here in the United States, or we're destroying it because we're paying farmers to roll under crops. Those things are happening right now while we're seeing these food crises. It looks like that some people are just going along with the government and, you know, the long projects. It looks like others want to see the destabilization that will come from a food crisis. Are we solving the problem? Well, I think patriotic farmers are trying to do so, but guess who owns all the farmland? The Chinese and Bill Gates and all the billionaires have been buying farmland. This is a very serious issue that we're going to have to face, but those outside the United States will have to face it even more directly because we'll just have higher prices. They may have absolute shortages and starvation.
You couldn't be more right about this. Whether it is all by design, whether it is part of a conspiracy, whether it's some people conspiring or some people trying to engineer certain outcomes, in a way, it doesn't matter, because if it succeeds, it will be horrific for millions and millions of Americans, and maybe imperiling our country. But if indeed what we're up against is a concerted collusion to that end, it means that we have to really drop everything and remedy the situation. And Kevin, I just can't tell you how much I appreciate Economic War Room. People need to both check out the shows and their battle plans, which Kevin produces, including one with Ross Kennedy's recommendations, required reading. Kevin, come back to us again soon with updates, if you would. Next up, Colonel Peter Metzger joins us. We'll talk about philanthropy for vets, making sure it gets to them, right after this.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back. We're going to talk about an issue that may or may not have come to your attention, but it is a serious problem and one that it's very exciting to see is being addressed at last. And that is, there are an awful lot of organizations that are devoted, at least ostensibly, to helping veterans, people who have served their country, some of whom have made the ultimate sacrifice, and their families are in need, some of whom are themselves in need. They've been injured, or they're simply trying to get a new lease on life as civilians. Unfortunately, not all of those organizations are well run or are doing the work that they claim to be doing. And I was delighted to learn recently of an initiative that is aimed at trying to both remedy the problem of ineffective management and improve the quality of philanthropy to the organizations that truly are helping those very deserving veterans and their families. I'm delighted to have with us for the first time a retired Marine colonel by the name of Peter Metzger. He served with great distinction in uniform, including as a Marine aide to my old boss, President Ronald Reagan. His last duty station back in the mid-1990s was at the pointy end of the spear with the Marine landing force for the Sixth Fleet. He is these days the chairman of the advisory board of the RAM Veterans Foundation. That stands for Robert Alexander Mercer Foundation. And we're going to talk with him about this new initiative of the foundation, charitiesforvets.org. Colonel, it's so good to have you with us. And thank you for, well, your past service to our country and that you're rendering right now. It's good to have you with us, sir.
You're very kind to have me, Frank. I wish I were nearly as articulate as you and talking about what we're doing. You've told the story very well.
We've only just whet people's appetite, I hope. Tell us just a little bit about the foundation, if you would, sir, because I was not aware of its existence and let alone the important work it's about.
Yeah, it was initiated by a famous, well-known philanthropist, Rebecca Mercer. And Rebecca's uncle, Robert A. Mercer, was killed in action in November 1944, 78 years ago. And in his memory, and in his honor, and in honor of all veterans, she is the initiator of the Robert A. Mercer Veterans Foundation. And the charitiesforvets.org is our public information outreach to educate two groups of people, those generous Americans who want to give money to veterans, and those who purport to take the money and give it to veterans.
Mm-hmm. So I've characterized a problem. Talk about it in more precise detail, if you would. The amounts of money that are involved are pretty impressive. The amounts that are going into it seems less effective organizations relative to the amounts getting to those doing the real work is, well, I guess impressive in a negative sense, alarming. Talk us through what you have found so far and what you're trying to do about it.
That's the crux of the problem. I'm about to give you a figure that I think will startle you and your listeners. In calendar year 2021, nearly $1 billion, that's with a B, $966 million were given to charities we would not recommend, as opposed to $330 million, a third of that, going to charities we do recommend. And when we saw those numbers, I was just floored. $1 billion going places where well-meaning Americans trying to do the right thing, and for some reason, it gets diluted along the way, and we can talk more about the metrics later. But that's the baseline number.
Yeah, and diluted along the way is a genteel way of describing what's happening in some of these cases. There have been some very prominent exposés of outfits that were simply, you know, making off with the money, essentially, and defrauding both the philanthropists, as you say, and the intended recipients. Give us a flavor of why this is. I mean, is it that it's so hard to run a charitable organization to help vets, or is it just that there are a lot of scoundrels in the business?
Well, I'll leave the descriptors to those people's imagination, but I will tell you that as we look at the publicly available information through IRS 990s and state's attorney's general report, all public, we see very clearly what's going on. And we looked at 78 of the biggest charities that purport to support vets. We approved 30 of them and not recommend 48. So we have a very simple system. There's three categories. It's pass-fail. You're either recommended, honorable, or not recommended. And on our website at charitiesforvets.org, you can see empirically, it tells you what the name of the organization is, where the money went. We've shown some examples of some egregious conduct. There's one that whose name I can't recall, but it's on our website. It's based in Florida, and it was initiated by a practicing physician who's licensed to practice medicine in Florida. And he and his wife and son, it's something about healing vets or medical vets. You can see it on the site. They collected $2,200,000, and they gave $13,000 to veterans. So the wife was being paid a $100,000 salary as the treasurer of the organization. This is just one example. There are some that are closer than others. And a couple of reasons that we give the grades we do, Frank, is that if an organization is spending more than 25% on overhead, we think that should change. If they're giving less than 75% of the annual budget to the veterans, we think that should change. Another factor is if the organization has more than 3 years' annual budget in reserve, we don't think that's a good idea because they're sitting on piles of cash. So an American watches a TV ad, sees a badly wounded soldier, Marine, airman, sailor, and says, I got to do something about that, writes a check, and throws a prayer up and says, I hope this goes to the right place. We're simply trying to put sunshine on the problem. And so here are the facts.
This is so important. And the metrics that you're using to evaluate what is being done, you know, obviously give people a structure for seeing what might be a red flag to them as well. I am struck by the fact that it's not quite pass fail. You've got honorable there. What puts groups into the honorable category, but not necessarily would you recommend them?
Well, the three categories are based on, there are four or five factors, two of which I talked about, 25% overhead, 75% going to veterans, and the third is sitting on a bunch of cash. A lot of people take and invest this money for the hopefully the idea that it'll grow in the future, but the veteran doesn't see that. So those are the metrics that are used. Now, by the way, Frank, if someone is not recommended, they can challenge that by showing us, we got that wrong. Here are some audited financials. We're okay with that. We're simply trying to disinfect the problem with sunshine.
Yeah. And again, I think this is such an important public service because, as you say, many of us either have a passion in our hearts for these men and women in uniform or formerly in uniform, or they're appealed to by advertising that can be pretty compelling about their difficulties after they've sacrificed on behalf of all of us for one reason or another. So the distinct opportunity for the misdirection of charitable gifts is very considerable. And so charitiesforvets.org is a sort of clearinghouse, as you say, for the information that people need to go to for you know, informed decisions about their philanthropy. And what has been the response to these efforts to make this whole process more transparent and rigorous on the part of the charities?
We're still in the early stage of this national campaign, but I will tell you the word anger is out there because people who have donated say, gosh, I wish I would have known this. We have two billboards in Times Square. That's how active we're being in this thing. And I think anger is a good word. People say, wait a second, I got a t-shirt and it's very distressing to people. Now, on the other hand, the veterans are very appreciative. I didn't know this, but there are nearly 20 million of us running around who served in uniform. And there is a real passion, as you know, you're an American patriot, for people wanting to help people. And we are the clearinghouse or the consumer report of that effort.
Yeah. And what a great idea. And branding it just that way, I think, is something that will make it even more attractive as a service to the philanthropy community. But I was asking, sir, about how have the organizations been responding, or is it too early to say you've gotten much of a response at this point? I assume the ones that are in the recommended category are really good with this, and the others not so happy.
Yeah, there has been. Again, Frank, we're very early in the process. We tried to roll this out in connection with Memorial Day, obviously. And so we've gotten some responses, and we've had some not recommended that said, you got that wrong. And our response simply is, thank you very much. Show us how to get it right. We're trying to improve your financial management as we see it.
Yeah. Yeah. And using not capricious or arbitrary standards, but, you know, sort of best practices, I think, for, various charitable organizations of any stripe. I've run one myself, and I know that these are things that, Charity Navigator and the like similarly apply. And again, this is in response to a demonstrable problem. You're not looking to make trouble. you're trying to correct a trouble where it already exists.
It's not a personal matter. It simply is trying to ensure that the veterans that we all love and cherish get the money that people want them to get without someone in the middle, for whatever reason, screwing it up.
Screwing it up, maybe to their benefit, maybe simply to the detriment of those that are the intended recipients. Whatever the reason, it should stop. And hopefully this, as you say, sunshine is the best disinfectant. And the sunshine that you're putting on it, I think, Pete Metzger, is tremendously important. And I really commend you for doing it. Pete, we have to let it go at that. Come back to us with updates, if you would, though. Please, sir. Next up, We're going to talk with Dr. Harold Rode about Iran, the Middle East, and more right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Within hours of the board that oversees the federal government's $800 billion retirement fund giving the Chinese Communist Party access to its participants' money, four Biden nominees to that board have signaled that they oppose the practice. In a letter to senators holding up their confirmation, the nominees to the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board wrote, quote, "We agree it is unfitting for Americans to invest in companies from China or elsewhere that undermine U.S. national security," unquote. Since that's what the Chinese communists are all about, and since every Chinese corporation must do their bidding, none should have access to Thrift Savings Plan funds. To assure military and civilian government employees won't unwittingly invest in our enemy, the Senate must not confirm these nominees until all Chinese companies are removed from mutual fund offerings endorsed by the current Thrift Savings Plan board membership. This is Frank Gaffney. We're back. We're going to drill down on a subject that continues to get inadequate attention in this country, despite the gravity of the danger posed by what our government is doing to aid and abet, to empower and, well, enrich a very dangerous regime, arguably one of the most dangerous in the world. That would be the Islamic Republic of Iran's revolutionary Ayatollahs and their Revolutionary Guard Corps. At this moment, the Biden administration seems determined to assure that that regime gets thermonuclear weapons. And a person who has devoted much of his life, notably in the government of the United States, including as really the duty expert in the Department of Defense, on Iran and much of the Middle East, for that matter, is our next guest. His name is Dr. Harold Rode. He is a distinguished senior fellow of the Gatestone Institute these days, a very valued colleague, an author, including of books for the Center for Security Policy Press that have shed light on the Islamic way of war, for example, as well as the nature of those who are practicing it, including, of course, the regime in Tehran. Harold Rode, it's good to have you back, although I think what is going on at the moment, as far as our government is concerned at least, very, very ominous indeed. But I think you may have some promising news out of Iran for a change, at least in the sense that change may be in the works there. Tell us about it.
Well, we've had revolts and demonstrations and riots that the regime has managed to put down in the past. And we can't know when this regime will be overthrown by the people. But it's sort of like Ravel's Bolero. What happens is you go up to a point in the music, you keep getting higher and higher, it plateaus, maybe it goes down a bit and keeps going up and up and up. And you don't know when it's going to, boom, go over the top. So I can't.
But you think that things happening. Are building
oh,
in that
yes,
direction.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Give us some of the evidence of it, Harold, other than people, you know, expressing their upset in various public ways. What are the most important as you see it?
First of all, there are massive riots all over the country. And the regime has tried to keep it local by shutting off the internet. But it's not local because you know that from the slogans that they're yelling. There, for example, have been serious riots in...
And you'd use that term advisedly, I assume. It's not just demonstrations. You're talking
yes.
about people violently engaging in actions against the government, the regime, the authorities.
You know that by the slogans that they're yelling. For example, the supreme leader, the Führer, of Iran, Khamenei. They're saying he's a murderer. His regime is illegitimate. In the past, it was just down with Khamenei. But to call him a murderer, in Iran, to go against, could you imagine people yelling out against Hitler in Germany? No way. It'd be the end of them, and very painfully so. Look, in the last year or so, there have been 300 executions that we know about. Now, that means there were more that we don't know about. The people know this, and Iranians exaggerate about everything. So the 300 could end up being 600. We'll see how the numbers change and get higher. Now,
And when you say public executions, you're talking about opponents of the regime who've been put to death?
Yes, exactly. Now, the stormtroopers of the regime are what are called the Basij. And you have, and we've got pictures of these things. We've got pictures, videos of the actual, let's call them riots or demonstrations, whatever. It doesn't matter. It's all the same. And what are they yelling? They're saying to the Basij troops, get out of here. Imagine people yelling that in Germany. No way. In the 30s. It wouldn't happen. They're vicious, vicious statements against the regime. Look, from what we know, in the last decade, the regime has spent more than $60 billion supporting terror all around the world. Now, this, who knows what the actual figure is? I'm sure we can't really know. The people.
But is there any doubt in your mind, Harold Rode, that some of that money spent on terrorism around the world came to them from the United States as a result of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action,
absolutely,
the so-called nuclear deal?
Look, when the JCPOA, the joint, the thing that Obama signed with them in 2015, somehow on pads or I don't know, they like $150 billion in cash, some absurd number, managed to make its way into Iran courtesy of our administration. The exact details, all I know is that, and it was, of course, hushed up because, of course, let's say the people who of reason don't really control our press here right now.
Well, they may have reason. Their reason is generally to support the regime in Washington and suppress everybody else.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. We can go on. Look, I don't know if I mentioned there's about a 300% now increase in the basic goods of Iran. What are they? Things like rice, bread, flour for bread, and meat. And the Iranians have been suffering galore. The point is they've taken it in stride in the past because there's nothing they can do. But the regime knows and the people knows that in mass numbers, they can be enormously dangerous. It's not only that they overthrew the Shah, but all throughout the Middle East, the regimes do their damnedest. They have to be very careful with large crowds. In soccer stadiums, that's one of the most dangerous places for the regime. They're all yelling right now. The phrase Abadan, Abadan. What is Abadan, Abadan? What happened in the last, I think, few days?
Harold, we're almost out of time for this block. I wanted you to hold the thought on what is Abadan, Abadan, because I think it is an insight into both how people are now viewing this regime and feeling as though they have nothing to lose in standing up against it. And we'll talk more about that on the other side of a very short break with Dr. Harold Rode, a former desk officer for Iran, Turkey, all manner of things in the Office of Net Assessment and other places in the Secretary of Defense's Office of the Pentagon. Go-to guy, right after this. Welcome back. We're speaking with Dr. Harold Rode, a longtime colleague and much admired mentor to many of us on matters involving the arcana of the Middle East, and in particular, what's really going on when people think something else is actually taking place. Harold's got keen insights born of a lot of hard experience and real cultural knowledge of various countries, notably Iran, which we're speaking about now in the midst of, it seems, a new upsurge in internal turmoil. And Harold, you were talking about people shouting Abadan, Abadan in the soccer stadiums across the country. And we were left hanging. What does that term refer to? And what is the significance of people seemingly en masse using it as an expression of outrage against the government?
Abadan is a city in Khuzestan where Iran's largest oil reserves are. Back in the Iranian Revolution, say 1978-79, what the regime did, there was a huge fire in a building in Abadan, in a theater, and a lot of people died. And that became the spark, the catalyst, which led to the overthrow of the Shah. Now, what happened now in Abadan in the last few days is that a building, which is in the process of being built with a lot of people inside of it at the time, simply collapsed. And it conjures up in people's minds exactly what happened in 78-79. Now, soccer stadiums are really, really dangerous places for the regime. Why? Because they can't control everybody and everything. Yes, it's enclosed, but when these people start yelling, Abadan, Abadan, the name of the city, we have the videos of this. The videos actually were placed, they're on Facebook. For anybody who wants to say, I'm happy, I can give you the link, Frank. And you see this, and this has to scare the regime. But even more importantly is another thing, that internally, with the serial events that are happening, attacks on Iranian nuclear facilities, attacks on scientists and all that, they're happening serially. So it obviously seems that it's planned. No, it's not the outsiders. They're blaming Israel, and from what it appears, the American government, who doesn't seem to be particularly happy with Israel, has blamed Israel for this publicly. Now, the Iranians, what is happening, but which is more important to us for hopefully the end of this regime eventually, is that senior leaders are publicly arguing, blaming each other for letting the Israelis do this, or why aren't we good enough, we Iranians? How come it's your fault? And in the Middle East, you never take responsibility for anything. You blame others. We're seeing this more and more. Again, I don't know when, I don't know what is going to be the final thing, but we're in line for that. At the same time, the Iranian government is rushing towards the nuclear bomb, because then, and they have no compunction whatsoever of using this on whatever. If there's a small little thing, they could do it to some of their own people, and they're not above doing such a thing.
Yeah. Death to Israel, and death to America, of course, are, as I said, leitmotifs of this regime. Harold, let me just ask you a question. I had Dr. Peter Vincent Pry on the program recently. I think you know him, one of our country's preeminent experts on nuclear matters, a former Central Intelligence Agency analyst on these sorts of topics. Peter says, and he mentioned former director of Central Intelligence, Jim Woolsey, among others, who have come to the same conclusion he has, which is that Iran actually already does have a nuclear weapon, that it has had one for some time. It has chosen not to demonstrate that it has one, not to test it, perhaps test it covertly in North Korea, but not to become publicly known to have the bomb, which would seem to be at odds with the general practice. Once people have it, they generally want to flaunt it because that seems to give them some confidence that they will not be overthrown, at least from external forces. What are your thoughts on that prospect? Is that realistic, do you think? Or would they not, if they had it, they would perhaps not only flaunt it, but use it?
I can only comment on the cultural aspects here and how they think about it. I am not an expert on nuclear issues. The Iranians could very easily, what they do is they have it and they make sure that others know it, but they don't say it, which leaves you in this, I'm not sure, yes, no, yes, no.
That ambiguity?
Yes,
that,
yes.
Calculated. Yeah.
Maybe they're copying Israel. Why Israel? We won't be the first to introduce or to use nuclear weapons in the Middle East. That's their answer to anything to do with the nuclear. Does everybody believe that? Yeah, but what's this? Maybe they're doing that. They're probably the slyest people that I know on the face of the earth. Just to give you an example, two of the best, it's unrelated, but the two of the best engineering schools in the world are in Iran. Now, what happens is these people graduate. They can't stand living there. 80 to 90% leave. And they have no problem getting good jobs here in the West. And academics, I mean, the people who follow their publications say it's absolutely first class. But they leave. So the regime is averaging.
That raises a host of questions about the advisability of having them actually integrated into our sensitive institutions and research labs and so on. Harold, unfortunately, we're out of time to pursue that thought further for the moment, but we'll have you back soon to do that. In the meantime, thank you for this deep dive on what is going on in Iran at the moment, and maybe some of it is actually hopeful. I certainly pray it is, because the people there deserve to be liberated. Not at our force of arms, but by their own will. They've been deprived that for far too long, and our policy ought to be about trying to encourage it and enable it, not prop up the regime, which is seemingly what Joe Biden is up to. Harold Rowe, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks to the rest of you for joining us. I hope you'll do so again next time, and that you are finding this helpful in figuring out how to help protect the country we love. That's what we're all about. And then I hope that you'll go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.